the cool things we can do, we can do, we can do. We love the cool things we can do on our computer.
When you need to talk technology, no one gets you more gigs in your hard drive than Adam. It's time for Adam the Computer Guy with Adam Lepp.
Well, hey there, and good morning. It's the Adam the Computer Guy radio show with me, Adam Lepp, your friendly neighborhood information technologist. Is that a word? Well, that's okay. It's kind of a cool-sounding designation anyway. Every Tuesday and Thursday, right after the 9 a.m. features, we get together and talk today's top technology topics, be it about computer security, keeping your data away from prying eyes, ears, and other things. Latest and greatest technology, self-driving cars, medical technology. We'll have an update on the Fitbit and some parties who don't like the Fitbit as much as people like myself do. We'll talk about that a little later in the show. Some other medical technology news, the latest and greatest shenanigans from Uber and from Lyft, and a few surprises like we always have here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio show. WWGH is your official. I guess you could say official. Even if we're not official, we are absolutely awesome with a capital A. Talk radio station in mid-Ohio. Please do visit our website, which does tend to get better every day, WWGH1071.com. If you miss my show, that's okay. I don't always like getting up early either, and 9 a.m. is still kind of early for me. You can listen to previous shows and podcasts, if you want to call them that. That's kind of the term for it, of my show and pretty much all the shows we've aired since the beginning of January when I started here on the station by going to the archive section at our website, WWGH1071.com. We take your telephone calls, Facebook messages, and, of course, emails. You can always contact me if you'd like to be on the show, offer your comments, interview me. I can interview you. Questions, even complaints, are always welcome. Hey, drop me a line, Adam at WWGH1071.com. We like to keep your computers working swimmingly. I guess that's a good word to use as we approach the swimming season. That is, keep them working efficiently, away from the viruses and malware and other junk that can definitely cause a few headaches. But we have some fun. We talk about some technology that is on the forefront. Again, be it related to healthcare and exercising, keeping fit. Vehicles, drones, that's always an interesting topic. Maybe the latest in phones. Phones and drones. And I'd rather have an ice cream cone, but they don't have an ice cream stand here at the station, so we'll just say drones and phones and leave it at that. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy. And let's take a look and see what we have here on my desk for the first news and views item of the day. Tearing through open spaces and timing each turn to burst out of them. A seeming continuum of drones weaves through a set of obstacles lap after lap until the stutter of a pilot's joystick breaks the cadence of this competitive concert and destroys the illusion. Gosh, that sounds fun. It's the drama, anticipating and reacting to those human moments, that has propelled drone racing from an underground scene in Australia 4 or 5 years ago to vying for a place in the sports mainstream today. See, I told you we're going to cover drones and phones, and I can assure you there will be an iPhone update later in the show, so stay tuned to a radio or virtual listening device near you. Anyway, drone racing is more than a group of pilots pushing their cinematographic drones from point A to point B. It is that simple at its core and from a distance. But the sport of drone racing is deeper and much more difficult, with its complicated courses drawing an increasing amount of attention in recent years. Drone racing is getting its shot at popularity. The International Drone Racing Association has signed a landmark deal with ESPN, and that happened last month in April, and the sport has been enjoying a market uptick in high-level cups, with payouts to winners regularly amounting to a lot more than I make working here, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think I'm in the wrong occupation. Anyway, racing drones are different from their cinematic counterparts, which have cameras on their bellies and automatic stabilizers. Competition drones have manual controls and front-mounted cameras, positioned to give pilots the optimal view for weaving through courses at speeds up to 80 miles per hour. Now, marrying human and machine in drone racing are first-person view headsets, which are linked remotely to the pilot's drone. It's a view that invokes in pilots the feeling of flying. Unhindered by automatic stabilizers, racing drones are much more nimble and, in turn, are exponentially more difficult to fly than the common consumer quadcopter. Maybe that's why these prizes are in the six figures. It is the rewarding rush of the races, along with the demand for dexterity and the social scene, that attracted McKenna McFly McClure to the sport. That's a pretty cool name, McKenna McFly McClure. He said, "I raced motorcycles for a bit, but the chances of getting hurt started to wear on me, and I moved away from it for a couple years." So McKenna McFly McClure took up drone racing last year and now ranks in the top 25 of more than 270 ranked pilots. He said, "Drone racing is the only thing that I've found that gives you that same rush doing 70 to 90 miles per hour a few feet off the ground. But if you crash, you just pull the goggles off and go back, pick up the pieces." He said, "The most rewarding out of all is the incredible people that I've met along the way in the last years." Some drone racing hurdles are as brightly lit as the neon rings that drone racing league pilots push their quadcopters through. Other hurdles are more subtle, such as the off-road style course. But the hurdles to drone racing apply to all participants equally. Now, like in any sport that's relatively new and a little different, one of the biggest challenges for the sport has been attracting spectators. Watching the pilot's feed can provoke a sense of motion sickness because spectators have to keep up with the action instead of controlling it. According to Mr. McClure, the pilots currently rely on analog signals patched into their drone's cameras. That view can be grainy, and pilots sometimes have to contend with a breakup in the video while they are racing. McClure said spectators want and need to have a great view for them to be interested in watching. Otherwise, you kind of get turned off by the view unless you're the one actually flying the drone. The videos that you see online are all captured through HD cameras, and that's not the video that we see while flying yet. Charles King from Pundit, we quote him pretty much every show because he's sort of the king of important opinions and excellent knowledge. He said, "There's also the issue of the visual impact that the drones make on spectators. Other than military-class drones, most of them are just too small to make much of a visual impression. So you could describe the sport today as being akin to what radio-controlled model cars are to NASCAR. Racing larger drones would be more exciting visually and also offer onboard real estate for sponsor logos, but would likely increase risks for live race audience members." So, a new sport to follow. Sounds kind of cool to me, and maybe I'll get involved, considering that the prizes can be in the hundreds of thousands of dollar range. I'd have to work at the station till the year 4,000 to make that much money, but that's cool. At least I stay on the ground in a virtual and actual sense, so maybe it's not quite that bad after all. Beep, beep. Yes, it's time to toot my own horn, and that's okay, because I want to tell you about the new website that we have. I mentioned it a bit earlier, but I want to stress that if you're on a mobile device, one of these new iPhones and Android phone, anything with a web browser, laptop, desktop, what have you, Just go to our website, click on the Listen Now button, and you can listen. It connects in seconds. The sound quality is excellent. The stream is more reliable. And you know, you can listen in the car. Just put the phone on Bluetooth. And as you are traveling the roads of this great country, just listen on your mobile device, again, directly or maybe with Bluetooth if you have that on your radio like I do. You can, of course, call the shows that we have, yes, on the station. And, of course, you can listen as well as go to the archive section of our website. That's what I wanted to say. And listen to shows that you might have missed or shows that are so good you want to listen to them again. An example of a show that I like to listen to more than once would be Scott Spears with his show called Now. It's not on now, but it is on at noon today. Anyway, Scott interviews local celebrities, people like Ron Scheiderer, Mary Ellen Withrow, but she's more of an international celebrity since she was the U.S. Treasurer. She was on last week, as well as interesting people from the Marion and Mid-Ohio area. He also has a penchant for speaking with show business people. For example, Mrs. Garrett, Charlotte Ray, was on last week discussing her new book, her recovery from alcoholism. Of course, she talked about the facts of life and a lot of other, that is the show, The Facts of Life, not The Facts of Life in general, but the show, The Facts of Life, as well as other interesting topics. If you missed the show, you can go to our show archives, go to the Now with Scott Spears section and listen to the Charlotte Ray interview on demand. Robert Guillaume from Benson and Soap, he was on earlier this month. Dear Abby, Heloise, Hugh Downs, the late Phyllis Diller, the late Abe Vigoda, they're all there. Check it out. WWGH1071.com. Scott with his celebrity interviews. Our local legend, Charlie Evers. Not overly legendary people, but interesting people like myself. I'm on there. Linda Sims, Marge and Martha, all there. Check it out. Our new and improved website, again, listen on demand or live on your smart device, your not-so-smart device, as long as it has a web browser or, of course, the good old computer. WWGH1071.com. My name is Adam Lepp, AdamTheComputerGuy.com. That's also my website. Well, a couple of them at least. And let's see. This is my twice weekly radio show on Marion's Talking Place, WWGH. Of course, that stands for Warren G. Harding, our president, who is from the Marion area. He was actually born in Blooming Grove, but he pretty much grew up here and ran the old newspaper. And we're very proud to name our station after this fine president of the United States of America. Let's see. What do we have here in the news and views department? We cover that here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio show. Keeping your computer safe, secure, and fun to use. If your server is only serving you headaches, your monitor is only monitoring your aggravation, or your printer is not printing, at least not printing what you wanted it to print, you've come to the right place because we cover that stuff here on the Adam the Computer Guy show. Microsoft. Often I discuss how I'm not overly thrilled with their Windows 10 semi-forced upgrade. Not always pleased with some of the latest developments in their operating system or other software. Let's turn our attention to their cracking down on terrorist content. I think I'm not necessarily a positive topic, but an important one. As I say, if your computer is not secure, not safe, then it definitely can cause some serious issues. Now, this is possibly in response to the Obama administration's intense effort to get Silicon Valley's help in preventing organizations like ISIS from using social media as a recruiting and fundraising tool. Microsoft has announced plans to crack down on terrorist content. So again, not necessarily as a foundation, a positive topic, but Microsoft's reaction and what they're doing, I think, is excellent. And again, I do try to show all sides here. Microsoft has amended its terms of use to prohibit the posting of terrorist content on its various platforms, extending the existing prohibition on hate speech and advocacy of violence against others. So in this case, a very good step for Microsoft. They've categorized terrorist content as material posted by or in support of any organizations in the Consolidated United National Security Council sanctions list, which includes groups that the UN Security Council considers terrorist organizations. According to Microsoft, this prohibition specifically deals with content that depicts graphic violence, encourages violent action, endorses a terrorist group or its acts, or encourages people to join such groups. It was inevitable that there would need to be new approaches to combat terrorism in the digital arena, according to Microsoft, noting the importance of the internet as a communications hub. Recent events have served as a reminder that the internet can be used for the worst reasons imaginable. Now, Microsoft will continue using its notice and takedown process for removing prohibited content. When brought to its attention through its online reporting tool, whether by governments, concerned citizens, or other groups, such content will be removed. Again, in my opinion, a very good step here. Not a very pleasant topic to discuss, but an important one. And I think Microsoft is being proactive and very responsible about this, setting an example for other companies. In a nod to censorship concerns, Microsoft said it would remove links to terrorist-related content from Bing search results when the takedown would be required of search providers under local law. The company already operates that way in France, for example, where police authorities routinely report links to terrorist-related content. Now, the anti-terror efforts Microsoft and other companies have undertaken should be effective. That comes from Todd Helmis, a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation. He said, in addition to limiting access to terror networks, the companies are providing alternative messaging. He said, what's noteworthy about Microsoft and what you are seeing from the other social media giants is that not only are these efforts to remove content or limit access to content, but also opportunities for counter content. That's also a very important aspect of this as well. Now, Microsoft routinely gets government requests for customer data. For example, during the second half of last year, they received over 39,000 requests involving more than 64,000 users globally. Twitter, Facebook, and others in recent months have taken steps to crack down on the use of their sites for terrorist activity, as well as hateful speech or content promoting violence. The changes followed the revelation that the shooters in the San Bernardino massacre in 2015 were inspired by social media linked to ISIS. Now, while concerned about violence against U.S. citizens, civil liberties advocates expressed concern that crackdowns like this may serve only to push dangerous speech underground while threatening the First Amendment rights of innocent civilians. Lee Rowland, a attorney for the ACLU, said, creating a free-floating ban on certain types of speech, no matter how controversial, only serves to hide controversial ideas in the shadows. It makes no one safer. She said public dialogue about racism, terrorism, and other evils is the most critical step in ultimately defeating it. So another perspective on this. Censorship of speech based on national security claims often backfires, as was the case when Apple voluntarily blocked applications that identified sites of U.S. drone strikes because they included objectionable material. And that comes from attorney Lee Rowland, who works for the ACLU. Microsoft plans to partner with non-governmental organizations to display public service announcements with links to positive messaging, as well as alternative narratives for some search queries, with the goal of deterring troubled individuals from heading down a path toward violence. Microsoft is seeking creative new ways to deal with the issue. For example, it is providing funding and technical support to Dartmouth College professor Hani Farid to develop a technology to help stakeholders identify copies of patently terrorist content, including images, as well as video and audio, Such a solution could help avoid the game of whack-a-mole that often occurs when content that is taken down soon reappears elsewhere. So, positive step, in my opinion, by Microsoft and some other perspectives on this, keeping terrorist content and content that might be terrorist or hateful off of the internet. Let me know what you think. This is certainly a hot topic that will be increasing in importance in the world that we live in. My phone number, yes, at the station is 740-383-9944. And, of course, you can always email me. I love to hear from you. Adam@WWGH1071.com. Let's turn our attention to the latest and greatest in upcoming gadgetry from Apple and the iPhone. They have long used LCD, or liquid crystal display, technology. But liquid crystal display is now considered second best. The top dog would be OLED, which stands for Organic Light Emitting Diode. How about that for some abbreviations? Early in the morning, but never hurts to sharpen the old brain cells. Now, as a rule of thumb, the OLED, that's kind of hard to say. Organic light emitting diode panels are lighter. They look better, and you can curve them. Some of the Android phones have a curve to them, which not only looks cool, but can be very functional. Android phones have been using OLED for several years, but drum roll, please. I forgot my drum kit, so we'll just do an imaginary or virtual drum roll. The iPhones that are due out next year in 2017 will have OLED panels. A Bloomberg article cites a sudden spike in demand for screen manufacturing technology as an indicator of suppliers preparing for a big increase in demand for OLED displays. Now, Bloomberg specifically quotes Applied Materials, a manufacturer of machines used in the production of displays. This equipment is going to Samsung, LG, Foxconn, and Sharp. Now, all these companies are primary suppliers of displays to Apple. Now, Applied Materials CEO Gary Dickerson said, "We all know who is the leader in terms of mobile products." Now, Applied Materials saw orders of $700 million in the span of 3 months, close to what it normally would see in a year. Now, the timing is right for the new screens to make it into the 2017 iPhones. New machinery being ordered now would be in place early next year, ready for a production run of components to be assembled for a fall 2017 iPhone 7S release. The report also coincides perfectly with a previous study, which claimed that Apple reached out to Samsung and LG about OLED displays in December of 2015. Now, the timeline sounds about what it should be. Apple reaches out a few months ago. The suppliers design new supply lines and now start ordering the heavy machinery that will take months to manufacture and ship, called connecting the old dots. Now, the most convincing part about this rumor is not the sales data. It's that moving to OLED displays is an obvious move for Apple. Now, these OLEDs have pixels that light themselves without needing a backlight. That makes for displays that are thinner, have more contrast, since only the necessary pixels will light up, and, goodness sakes, better battery life. So some stuff on the way, very likely for Apple. We'll keep you posted, as we do here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio show, on Marion's Talking Place, WWGH 107.1 on your FM dial. Hey, join the conversation. So what is Uber up to? you may ask. Well, they gave a friendly heads up to pedestrians and drivers in Pittsburgh, not to mention investors and competitors. The car on the road in Pittsburgh with the strange-looking gizmos on top is learning how to drive itself. Yes, the latest wrinkle in the self-driving vehicle arena, I guess we could call it that. Anyway, a specially outfitted hybrid Ford Fusion, complete with radars, laser scanners, and high-resolution cameras to map details of the environment, will be on the streets of Pittsburgh very soon. It'll be collecting mapping data and testing its self-driving abilities. Uber said a trained driver will be in the driver's seat monitoring operations while the car is in self-driving mode. And Adam says, thank goodness for that. Anyway, the tests are part of Uber's efforts still in the early stages to develop autonomous driving technology. Uber said in a blog post that self-driving cars have the potential to save millions of lives and improve quality of life for people around the world, citing a statistic that 94% of car accidents that result in the loss of life involve human error. In February of last year, Uber announced it would partner with Carnegie Mellon University to open its Uber Advanced Technology Center in Pittsburgh. It is preparing to launch autonomous vehicles into its fleet by 2020. So how about that? You hail a cab and there's no driver. You still have to tip the cab. But I guess with Uber, the tip is kind of put into the app. So you kind of do that on your phone or computer anyway. But I'm not sure I'd want to have a taxi driver who wouldn't be a driver, but would be a machine. But we'll save that for another day, a little bit early today, to talk about virtual taxi drivers. Earlier this month, Lyft and Uber are kind of like Coke and Pepsi. Anyway, Lyft, along with General Motors, said the companies would begin testing a fleet of self-driving electric taxis on public roads. Now, details of this autonomous taxi testing program are still being worked out, according to the Wall Street Journal. But it will include customers in a yet-to-be-disclosed city. And I'd say if it's going to be in the Marion area, let me know. I think I'll stay home that day. Anyway, the moves by Lyft and Uber come as automakers and Silicon Valley giants like Google parent Alphabet Incorporated. That's the new name for the umbrella company, so to speak, which is essentially Google and all of its other things that it does. Anyway, they are quickly moving to commercialize autonomous driving. Executives at Lyft and Uber have said one of the top hurdles to their success is navigating a patchwork of regulations that govern the use and liabilities of autonomous vehicles. Federal regulators are working to help companies figure out how to meet safety standards when designing cars. The Adam the Computer Guy Show here with the latest and greatest in technology from all directions. And autonomous vehicles being a favorite topic of mine. Let me know what you think. I'd love to get your emails. Adam at WWGH1071.com.
Adam Lapp!
A San Francisco-based company has won a U.S. government-sponsored competition with an alcohol monitoring device, which can be worn on the wrist. This is the latest milestone in the development of wearable technologies that monitor and diagnose medical conditions. It's called BACTRAC for blood alcohol content, BAC track. It's a privately held medical device maker, and they took this prize worth $200,000 in the National Institute of Health Wearable Biosensor Challenge with its wristband monitor, dubbed the BACTRAC Skin, SKYN. It measures blood alcohol levels by way of sweat on the skin. Pretty cool, if I should say so myself. Dr. George Koob, head of the National Institute of Health's National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. My gosh, that's quite the title. Anyway, Dr. Koob said he expected the device to be a valuable resource for alcohol research and people studying the abuse of alcohol, and hopefully trying to control this rather serious problem. Dr. Koob said it can help doctors and other medical professionals accurately measure a patient's drinking history and not just depend on the most recent tests. This can help a lot with the treatment. Medical law enforcement and transportation officials have long tried to get better technologies for detection of blood alcohol levels. Now, the traditional portable blood alcohol tester can cost over $1,000, and it does not provide ongoing monitoring of alcohol levels. Keith Notacker, president of Backtrack, said the blood alcohol monitoring devices used in legal and medical circles are big and bulky, like a ball and chain for the ones using it. We wanted to make something people would want to wear. The device in its current form will not, however, be a substitute for breathalyzers or breath tests used by law enforcement because the device does not provide real-time blood alcohol levels. Keith Notacker, again president of the company Backtrack, said it takes about 45 minutes for ethanol to be transmitted through the skin, and that the device is designed to provide a recent history of alcohol use. Backtrack has been experimenting with consumer-centric alcohol testing for several years. 3 years ago, it introduced the Backtrack Mobile Breathalyzer, which syncs with a smartphone to track blood alcohol content. Backtrack beat seven other smaller companies to win the National Institute of Health competition. Milo, a Santa Barbara-based technology company, won the second-place prize of $100,000 for its design of a wearable alcohol content tracker that also uses a skin sensor and communicates with a smartphone using wireless technology. Here's a little story for you on some of the magic that we can use to find out what people are doing or what kind of a mental state they're in based upon their tweets, their Twitter usage. According to a paper by Rochester University computer science professors that was published early in March, we can identify the behavior of people who tweet in real time and locate them to within about 300 feet. The research team focused on discovering patterns of alcohol use in urban and suburban settings to better understand where and how people drink. Now, drinking results in about 75,000 deaths annually in the United States. And obviously, this information is valuable and can be used in public health efforts. Jim McGregor, a principal analyst at Turios Research, said, "The more interesting information that could be derived from this study is not the location tracking, but the personality links between those that post frequently and their drinking habits." Have you ever had a friend just make a bunch of tweets that make very little sense or have trivial information, and maybe you thought that person was hitting the bottle a few too many times? Well, this certainly gets into that topic, and it obviously can be used as a safety tool, but is also one that shows how people's online patterns are related to their behavior. Now, Jim McGregor said the potential information that can be derived is almost endless, depending on who's looking at the data and what they are looking for. Now, he said the technique could be a useful tool for analyzing data for direct marketing, for traffic patterns, or it could be used by police to track potential drunk drivers, by criminals to track when people are away from their home, or by insurance companies to track the unhealthy habits of clients. So it could be very useful. Watch what you tweet. And if you do it when you are not sober, there could be some consequences. Now, the team collected geotagged tweets from urban, suburban, and rural areas of New York State from July 2013 through July 2014, pre-processed them, and to make them easier to analyze, they used Amazon's Mechanical Turk to create a training set that captures details like whether the tweets mention drinking alcohol, or if the user mentioned drinking, or the user mentioned drinking when tweeting. The approach adhered to the concept of human-guided machine learning, introduced in a paper in 2013. So some pretty deep stuff. You'd think tweeting wouldn't be such an analytical vehicle, but in this case, it's not only an interesting research study, but can save some lives and keep drunk drivers off the road. Now, these researchers created a hierarchy of three support vector machine, or SVM, classifiers to distinguish the fine details. So some pretty deep stuff there. They performed fine-grained home location inference of Twitter users by training one of these SVM support vector machine classifiers to predict home location for active users, those with five or more geotagged tweets within a grid of 300 feet by 300 feet. So they knew almost precisely where this person was tweeting from. So some very in-depth research and some complicated programming used to show the usefulness of the study. Now, this methodology can be used to analyze what users of social media are doing if they post about their activities, as well as when they're doing it, and if their devices are location-enabled, where they're doing it. So is somebody tweeting from a bar or a party, or unfortunately drinking while driving? So there's some major safety implications here, and it could definitely save lives and make it easier to enforce laws that involve keeping impaired drivers off the road. Mukul Krishna, a senior global director at Frost & Sullivan, said, "Analyzing people's location and content and correlating it has been done before, but the approach is general. The new ideas are a way to distinguish tweets that are about a topic in general from those that are about the user doing that thing at that moment and guessing the user's home location." Now, he said the data can be used to build communities of people, then segment those communities' members and serve up through ad exchanges, very focused ads for that particular segment. So it can be used for advertising also. A lot of implications here. He said the approach could be used during, elections. If a significant number of people discussed a particular candidate, conclusions consistent with what was discussed could be made. It could also help in deciding where to locate a business. Based on travel patterns of the sample, users could include ideas about where to build the next big bar. Marketing and advertising efforts could also be further refined, as you could likely even make accurate differentiations based on age and sex from the information supplied by Twitter. Larry Chiagouris, a professor at Pace University, said that might backfire because the more effective this becomes in terms of its use to target customers, the more negative reaction and backlash we will see from the people who believe privacy is more important than effective marketing. So we get into privacy, into to safety, and how a tweet may give you some information about the person and what he or she might be doing, and if it might be a dangerous activity. So some interesting points there. Let me know what you think. You know, is this overstepping the line of privacy, or is it important because we can, again, save lives and, goodness sakes, do marketing, which is another wrinkle in the whole idea. Adam here, the computer guy, with my radio show. News and views and commentary, wisecracks, and always a surprise or two. Thank you very much for listening. Let me know what you think about the show. Questions, comments, suggestions, and even complaints are welcome. You can email me directly at my studio, adam@lep.fm. So we frequently talk about the Fitbit and related devices here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio show, and kind of assume the Fitbit is accurate, but it looks like it may not be, and that may cause a wrinkle in the situation. There's in fact been a class action lawsuit filed against Fitbit, and this lawsuit may have been gaining in momentum following a release of a study which claims that Fitbit's popular heart rate trackers are, quote, highly inaccurate. Researchers at the California State Polytechnic University in Pomona tested the heart rates of 43 healthy adults with Fitbit's Pure Pulse heart rate monitors. Using the company's Surge watches and Charge HR bands on each wrist. The people were hooked up to a bioharness device, which produced an electrocardiogram to record the heart's rhythm against the data being produced by Fitbit's devices. Comparative results from rest and exercise, including jump rope, treadmills, stair climbing, and outdoor jogging, showed that the Fitbit devices miscalculated heart rates by up to 20 beats per minute on the average during more intensive workouts. Rather concerning. 20 beats per minute is quite a bit. The study said that the Pure Pulse trackers do not accurately measure a user's heart rate, particularly during moderate to high-intensity exercise, and cannot be used to provide a meaningful estimate of a user's heart rate. The study was commissioned by the Leif Cabracer, a law firm behind the class action suit that is taking aim at three Fitbit models that use the Pure Pulse heart monitor. And those include the Blaze, Charge HR, and Surge. What the plaintiff's attorneys call a study is biased, according to a statement from Fitbit. They said that it's baseless and nothing more than an attempt to extract a payout from Fitbit. It lacks scientific rigor and is the product of flawed methodology. And that comes from Fitbit. So is this study of inaccuracy inaccurate itself? I guess the lawyers can make that decision. Hopefully we can come to a resolution, as I think the Fitbit and related devices are valuable, but if the information is not accurate, then they're obviously not. The study was paid for by the plaintiff's attorneys who are using Fitbit and was conducted with a consumer-grade electrocardiogram, not a true clinical device, as implied by the plaintiff's lawyers. Furthermore, there is no evidence that the device used in the purported study was tested for accuracy. Again, that comes from Fitbit. Fitbit also said that their research team rigorously researched and developed Pure Pulse technology for 3 years prior to introducing it to market and continues to conduct extensive internal studies to test the features of its products. So some battleground there between attorneys and people saying that, well, I guess attorneys are people, but attorneys and people who are not attorneys, how about that? Claiming the Fitbit does not provide an accurate heart rate monitor, and Fitbit saying that, yes, it does. Calculating a heart rate that's off by 20 to 30 beats per minute can be dangerous, especially for people at high risk of heart disease. That, of course, comes from the plaintiffs. So a battle there between Fitbit and attorneys and non-attorneys who have used the product and don't believe that it's as accurate as is being claimed. So we'll follow that story, and I think that medical devices and technology are an important topic and one that can help you in quest to stay healthy, stay away from the doctor's office, and live a productive life. If you've used a Fitbit, let me know what you think. Do you feel that it is accurate? Do you think that the lawsuit is frivolous, or is it one that we need to heed? My phone number here at the station is 740-383-9944. Of course, you can also email me. I'd love to hear from you. Adam@WWGH1071.com.
Do you ever ponder? Do you ever wonder? Do you ever question? Did my server serve me? Your computer will print. Should you call the president? What in the world are you gonna do? Call Adam, the computer guy. call Adam. Don't know the reason why. So you find it a waste of time. Because you cannot hear online. Call Adam. The computer guy. Or go online at thecomputerguy.com.